Oh, Jonas said. He leaned closer to the photo, studying it. You kind of look like Grandpa. Steve wasn't sure what to think about that. Maybe a little. Do you miss him? He was my dad. What do you think? I'd miss you. As Jonah came to the table, Steve reflected that it had been a satisfying, if uneventful, day. They'd spent the morning in the shop where Steve had taught Jonah to cut glass. They'd eaten sandwiches on the porch and collected seashells in the late afternoon. And Steve had promised that as soon as it was dark, he would take Jonah for a walk down the beach with flashlights to watch the hundreds of spider crabs darting in and out of their sand burrows. Jonah pulled out his chair and plopped down. He took a drink of milk, leaving a white mustache. Do you think Ronnie's coming home soon? I hope so. Jonah wiped his lip with the back of his hand. Sometimes she stays out pretty late. I know. Is a police officer going to bring her back home again? Steve glanced out the window. Dusk was coming and the water was turning opaque. He wondered where she was and what she was doing. No, he said. Not tonight. After their walk along the beach, Jonah took a shower before crawling into bed. Steve pulled up the covers and kissed him on the cheek. Thanks for the great day, Steve whispered. You're welcome. Good night, Jonah. I love you. Me too, Dad. Steve rose and started for the door. Hey, Dad? Steve turned. Yes? Did your dad ever take you out to look for spider crabs? No, Steve said. Why not? That was awesome. He wasn't that kind of father. What kind was he? Steve considered the question. He was complicated, he finally said. At the piano, Steve recalled the afternoon 6 years earlier when he took his father's hand for the first time in his life. He had told his father that he knew he'd done the best he could in raising him, that he didn't blame his father for anything, and that most of all, he loved him. His father turned toward him. His eyes were focused, and despite the high doses of morphine that he'd been taking, his mind was clear. He stared at Steve for a long time before pulling his hand away.
You sound like a woman when you talk like that, he said.
They were in a semi-private room on the fourth floor of the hospital. His father had been there for 3 days. IV tubes snaked out of his arms, and he hadn't eaten solid food in more than a month. His cheeks were sunken, and his skin was translucent. Up close, Steve thought his father's breath smelled of decay, another sign the cancer was announcing its victory. Steve turned toward the window. Outside, he could see nothing but blue skies, a bright, unyielding bubble surrounding the room. No birds, no clouds, no visible trees. Behind him, he could hear the steady beep of the heart monitor. It sounded strong and steady, with regular rhythm, making it seem that his father would live another 20 years. But it wasn't his heart that was killing him. How is he? Kim asked later that night when they were talking on the phone. Not good, he said. I don't know how much longer he has, but... He trailed off. He could imagine Kim on the other end, standing near the stove, stirring pasta or dicing tomatoes, the phone cocked between her ear and shoulder. She'd never been able to sit still when talking on the phone. Did anyone else come by? No, he answered. What he didn't tell her was that, according to the nurses, no one else had visited at all. Were you able to talk to him? She asked. Yes, but not for long. He was drifting in and out most of the day. Did you say what I told you to say? Yes, he said. What did he say? She asked. Did he say he loved you too? Steve knew the answer she wanted. He was standing in his father's home, inspecting the photos on the mantle. the family after Steve was baptized, a wedding photo of Kim and Steve, Ronnie and Jonah as toddlers. The frames were dusty, untouched in years. He knew that it had been his mother who put them there, and as he stared at them, he wondered what his father thought as he looked at them, or if he even saw them at all, or if he even realized they were there. "Yes," he finally said. "He told me he loved me." "I'm glad," she said. Her tone was relieved and satisfied, as though his answer had affirmed something to her about the world. "I know how important that was to you." Steve grew up in a white ranch-style house in a neighborhood of white ranch-style houses on the intracoastal side of the island. It was small, with two bedrooms, a single bathroom, and a separate garage that housed his father's tools and smelled permanently of sawdust. The backyard, shaded by a gnarled live oak that held its leaves year-round, didn't get enough sun, so his mother planted the vegetable garden in the front. She grew tomatoes and onions, turnips and beans, cabbage and corn, and in the summers, it was impossible to see the road that fronted the house from the living room. Sometimes Steve would overhear the neighbors grumbling in hushed voices, complaining about declining property values. But the garden was replanted every spring, and no one ever said a word directly to his father. They knew as well as he did that it wouldn't have done them any good. Besides, they liked his wife, and they all knew they would need his services one day. His father was a trim carpenter by trade, but he had a gift for fixing anything. Over the years, Steve had seen him repair radios, televisions, auto and lawnmower engines, leaking pipes, dangling gutters, broken windows, and once, even the hydraulic presses of a small tool manufacturing plant near the state line. He'd never attended high school, but he had an innate understanding of mechanics and building concepts. At night when the phone rang, his father always answered, since it was usually for him. Most of the time he said very little, listening as one emergency or another was described, and then Steve would watch him carefully jot the address on pieces of scratch paper torn from old newspapers. After hanging up, his father would venture to the garage, fill his toolbox, and head out, usually without mentioning where he was going or when he would be back home. In the morning, the check would be tucked neatly beneath the statue of Robert E. Lee that his father had carved from a piece of driftwood, and his mother would rub his back and promise to deposit it at the bank as his father ate his breakfast. It was the only regular affection he noticed between them. They didn't argue and avoided conflict as a rule. They seemed to enjoy each other's company when they were together, and once he caught them holding hands while watching TV. But in the 18 years Steve had lived at home, he never saw his parents kiss. If his father had one passion in life, it was poker. On the nights the phone didn't ring, his father went to one of the lodges to play. He was a member of those lodges, not for the camaraderie, but for the games. There he would sit at the table with other Freemasons or Elks or Shriners or veterans playing Texas Hold'em for hours. The game transfixed him. He loved computing the probabilities of drawing an outside straight or deciding whether to bluff when all he held was a pair of sixes. When he talked about the game, he described it as a science, as if the luck of the draw had nothing to do with winning. "The secret is to know how to lie," he used to say, "and to know when someone's lying to you." His father, Steve eventually decided, must have known how to lie. In his 50s, with his hands nearly crippled from over 30 years of carpentry, his father stopped installing crown molding and door frames in the custom oceanfront homes that had begun to spring up on the island. He also began to leave the phone unanswered in the evenings. Somehow, he continued to pay his bills, and by the end of his life, He had more than enough in his accounts to pay for the medical care his insurance didn't cover. He never played poker on Saturday or Sunday. Saturdays were reserved for chores around the house, and while the garden in the front yard may have bothered the neighbors, the interior was a showpiece. Over the years, his father added crown molding and wainscoting. He carved the fireplace corbels from 2 blocks of maple. He built the cabinets in the kitchen and installed wood floors that were as flat and sure as a billiard table. He remodeled the bathroom, then remodeled it again 8 years later. Every Saturday evening, he put on a jacket and tie and took his wife to dinner. Sundays, he reserved for himself. After church, he would tinker in his workshop, while his wife baked pies or canned vegetables in the kitchen. On Monday, the routine started all over again. His father never taught him to play the game. Steve was smart enough to learn the basics on his own, and he liked to think he was keen enough to spot someone bluffing. He played a few times with fellow students in college and found out he was simply average, no better or worse than any of the others. After he graduated and moved to New York, he'd occasionally come down to visit his parents. The first time, he hadn't seen them in 2 years, and when he walked through the door, his mom hugged him fiercely and kissed him on the cheek. His father shook his hand and said, "Your mom's missed you." Apple pie and coffee were served, and after they finished eating, his dad stood, reaching for his jacket and car keys. It was a Tuesday. That meant he was going to the Elks Lodge. The game ended at 10, and he would be home 15 minutes later. "No, no go tonight," his mom urged, her European accent as heavy as ever. "Steve just got home." He remembered thinking that it was the only time he'd ever heard his mom ask his father not to go to the lodge. But if he was surprised, his father didn't show it. He paused at the doorway, and when he turned around, his face was unreadable. "Or take him with you," she urged. He draped his jacket over his arm. "Do you want to go?" "Sure," Steve drummed his fingers on the table. "Why not? That sounds like fun." After a moment, his father's mouth twitched, exhibiting the tiniest and briefest of smiles. Had they been at the poker table, Steve doubted he would have shown even that much. "You're lying," he said. His mom passed away suddenly a few years after that encounter when an artery burst in her brain, and in the hospital, Steve was thinking of her sturdy kindness when his father woke with a low wheeze. He rolled his head and spotted Steve in the corner. At that angle, with shadows playing across the sharp angles of his face, he gave the impression of being a skeleton. "You're still here." Steve set aside the score and scooted the chair closer. "Yeah, I'm still here." "Why?" "What do you mean, why?" "Because you're in the hospital."
"I'm in the hospital because I'm dying. And I'd be dying whether you were here or not. You should go home. You have a wife and kids. There's nothing you can do for me here."
"I want to be here," Steve said. "You're my father. Why, don't you want me here?"
"Maybe I don't want you to see me die."
"I'll leave if you want." His father made a noise akin to a snort.
"See, that's your problem. You want me to make the decision for you. That's always been your problem."
"Maybe I just want to spend time with you."
"You want to, or did your wife want you to? Does it matter?"
His dad tried to smile, but it came out like a grimace.
"I don't know. Does it?"
From his spot at the piano, Steve heard an approaching car. The headlights flashed through the window and raced across the walls, and for an instant he thought that Ronnie might have gotten a ride home. But just as quickly, the lights shrank to nothing, and Ronnie still wasn't here. It was after midnight. He wondered whether he should try to find her. Some years ago, before Ronnie had stopped talking to him, he and Kim had gone to see a marriage counselor whose office was located near Gramercy Park in a renovated building. Steve remembered sitting beside Kim on a couch and facing a thin, angular woman in her 30s who wore gray slacks and liked to press her fingertips together. When she did, Steve noticed she didn't wear a wedding band. Steve was uncomfortable. The counseling had been Kim's idea, and she'd already gone alone. This was their first joint session, and by way of introduction, she told the counselor that Steve kept his feelings bottled up inside, but that it wasn't his fault. Neither of his parents had been expressive people, she said. Nor had he grown up in a family that discussed their problems. He sought out music as an escape, she went on to say, and it was only through the piano that he learned to feel anything at all. Is that true? The counselor asked. My parents were good people, he answered. That doesn't answer the question. I don't know what you want me to say. The counselor sighed. Okay, how about this? We all know what happened and why you're here. I think what Kim wants is for you to tell her how it made you feel. Steve considered the question. He wanted to say that all this talk of feelings was irrelevant, that emotions come and go and can't be controlled, so there's no reason to worry about them, that in the end, people should be judged by their actions, since in the end, it was actions that defined everyone. But he didn't say this. Instead, he threaded his fingers together. You want to know how it made me feel? Yes, but don't tell me, she gestured to his wife. Tell Kim. He faced his wife, sensing her anticipation. I felt... He was in an office with his wife and a stranger, engaged in the type of conversation he could never have imagined growing up. It was a few minutes past 10 o'clock in the morning, and he'd been back in New York for only a few days. His tour had taken him to 20-some different cities, while Kim worked as a paralegal at a Wall Street law firm. I felt, he said again. When the clock struck 1 a.m., Steve went outside to stand on the back porch. The blackness of the night had given way to the purple light of the moon, making it possible to see up and down the beach. He hadn't seen her in 16 hours and was concerned, if not quite worried. He trusted she was smart and careful enough to take care of herself. Okay, maybe he was a little worried. And despite himself, he wondered if she was going to vanish tomorrow, the same way she had today, and whether it would be the same story day after day all summer. Spending time with Jonah had been like finding special treasure, and he wanted to spend time with her as well. He turned from the porch and went back inside. As he took his seat at the piano, he felt it again, the same thing he'd told the marriage counselor as he'd sat on the couch. He felt empty.
Chapter 10. Ronnie. For a while, a larger group had gathered at Bowers Point, but one by one, they'd taken off until only the 5 regulars remained. Some of the others had been okay, a couple were even kind of interesting. But then the liquor and beer started taking effect, and everyone but Ronnie thought that they were a lot funnier than they really were. After a while, it got kind of boring and familiar. She was standing alone at the water's edge. Behind her, near the bonfire, Teddy and Lance were smoking, drinking, and occasionally throwing fireballs at each other. Blaze was slurring her words and hanging all over Marcus. It was getting late, too. Not by New York standards. Back home, she didn't show up at the clubs until midnight. But considering what time she'd gotten up, it had been a long day. She was tired. Tomorrow, she was going to sleep in. When she got home, she was going to hang towels or a blanket over the curtain rod. Hell, she'd nail them to the wall if she had to. She had no intention of spending the whole summer rising with the farmers, even if she was going to spend the day at the beach with Blaze. Blaze had surprised her with the suggestion, and it actually sounded kind of appealing. Besides, there wasn't much to do otherwise. Earlier, after they'd left the diner, they'd walked through most of the nearby shops, including the music store, which was very cool, and afterward, they'd gone to Blaze's house to watch The Breakfast Club while her mom was at work. Sure, it was an 80s movie, but Ronnie still loved it and had seen it at least a dozen times. Even though it was dated, it felt surprisingly real to her. More real than what was going on here tonight. Especially since the more Blaze drank, the more she ignored Ronnie and clung to Marcus. Ronnie already neither liked nor trusted Marcus. She had pretty good radar when it came to guys, and she sensed that there was something off about him. It was like there was something missing in Marcus's eyes when he talked to her. He said the right things. No more crazy suggestions about heading to Florida, at least. And by the way, how weird was that? But the more time she spent with him, the more he creeped her out. She didn't like Teddy or Lance either, but Marcus, she got the vibe that acting normal was simply a game he played so he could manipulate people. And Blaze, it was strange being in her house earlier because it seemed so normal. It stood in a quiet cul-de-sac and had bright blue shutters and an American flag that fluttered from the porch. Inside, the walls were painted cheery colors and a vase of fresh flowers stood on the dining room table. The place was clean, but not neurotically so. In the kitchen, there was some money on the table, along with a note addressed to Blaze. When Ronnie caught Blaze sliding a few bills into her pocket and reading the note, Blaze mentioned that her mom always left money for her. It was how she knew Blaze was okay when she didn't come home. Odd. What she really wanted was to talk to Blaze about Marcus. But she knew that wouldn't do any good. Lord knows she learned that from Kayla. Kayla lived in denial. But even so, it didn't make sense. Marcus was bad news, and Blaze was clearly better off without him. She wondered why Blaze couldn't see that. Maybe tomorrow they'd talk about it at the beach. Are we boring you? Turning, she saw Marcus standing behind her. He was holding a fireball, letting it roll across the back of his hand. I just wanted to come down to the water. Do you want me to bring you a beer? By the way he asked, she could tell he already knew what she was going to say. I don't drink. Why? Because it makes people act stupid, she could have said. But she didn't. She knew that any explanation she offered would only prolong the conversation. I just don't, that's all. Just say no, he taunted. If you say so. In the darkness, he wore the ghost of a smile, but his eyes remained shadowy pits. Do you think you're better than us? No. Then come on, he gestured to the bonfire. Sit with us. I'm fine. He glanced over his shoulder. Behind him, Ronnie could see Blaze digging through the cooler for another beer, which was the last thing she needed. She was already unsteady on her feet. Without warning, he took a step toward her, reaching for her waist. He squeezed, pulling her closer to him. Let's walk the beach. No, she hissed. I'm not in the mood, and take your hand off me. It stayed in place. She could tell Marcus was enjoying this. You worried about what Blaze would think? I just don't want to, okay? Blaze won't care. She took a step back, increasing the distance between them. I do, she said. And I've got to go. He continued to stare at her. Yeah, you do that. Then, after a pause, he spoke up so the others could hear. Nah, I'll just stay here. But thanks for asking. She was too shocked to say anything in response. Instead, she started down the beach, knowing that Blaze was watching, and suddenly thinking she couldn't get away fast enough. At home, her father was playing the piano, and as soon as she walked in, he peeked at the clock. After what had just happened, she wasn't in the mood to deal with him, so she started for the hallway without a word. He must have seen something in her face, however, because he called out to her. Are you okay? She hesitated. Yeah, I'm fine, she said. You sure? I don't want to talk about it. He studied her before answering. Okay. Is there anything else? It's almost 2 a.m., he pointed out. And? He bent over the keyboard. There's some pasta in the fridge if you're hungry. She had to admit he'd surprised her with that one. No lecture, no orders, no laying down the law. Pretty much the opposite of how Mom would have handled it. She shook her head and walked to the bedroom, wondering if anyone or anything was normal down here. She forgot to hang blankets over the windows, and the sun lasered into the room, waking her after she'd slept for less than 6 hours. Groaning, she rolled over and pulled the pillow on top of her head when she remembered what had happened at the beach the night before. Then she sat up, knowing sleep was out of the question. Marcus definitely creeped her out. Her first thought was that she should have said something last night when he had called out. Something like, "What the hell are you talking about?" Or, "If you think I'd go anywhere alone with you, you're out of your mind." But she hadn't, and she suspected that simply walking away was the worst thing she could have done. She really, really had to talk to Blaze. With a sigh, she swung herself out of bed and padded to the bathroom. Quickly, she showered and threw on a bathing suit beneath her clothes, and then filled a tote bag with towels and lotion. By the time she was ready, she could hear her father playing the piano. Again. Even back in the apartment, he'd never played this much. Focusing on the music, she realized he was playing one of the pieces she performed at Carnegie Hall, the same one on the CD that her mom had been playing in the car. As if she didn't have enough to deal with right now. She needed to find Blaze so she could explain what happened. Of course, how to do that without making Marcus out to be a liar might be a problem. Blaze would want to believe Marcus, and who knew what the guy had said after she left. But she'd cross that bridge when she came to it. Hopefully, lying in the sun would keep things mellow, and she could bring it up naturally. Ronnie left her bedroom and walked down the hall just as the music from the living room ended, only to be followed by the second piece she'd played at Carnegie Hall. She paused, adjusting the tote bag on her shoulder. Of course he'd do that. No doubt because he'd heard the shower and knew she was awake. No doubt because he wanted them to find common ground. Well, not today, Dad. Sorry, but she had things to do. She really wasn't in the mood for this. She was about to make a dash to the front door when Jonah emerged from the kitchen. "Didn't I say you were supposed to get something good for you?" she heard her dad ask. "I did. It's a Pop-Tart." "I was thinking more along the lines of cereal." "This has sugar." Jonah wore an earnest expression. "I need my energy, Dad." She started to walk quickly through the living room, hoping to make it to the door before he tried to talk to her. Jonah smiled. "Oh, hey, Ronnie," he said. "Hi, Jonah. Bye, Jonah." She reached for the door handle. "Sweetheart," she heard her dad say. He stopped playing. "Can we talk about last night?" "I really don't have time to talk right now," she said, adjusting her tote bag. "I just want to know where you were all day." "Nowhere. It's not important."
"It is important."
"No, Dad," she said, her voice firm. "It isn't, and I've got things to do, okay?" Jonah motioned to the door with his Pop-Tart. "What things? Where are you going now?"
This was exactly the conversation she'd hoped to avoid. "It's none of your business."
"How long are you going to be gone?"
"I don't know."
"Will you be back for lunch or dinner?"
"I don't know," she huffed. "I'm leaving."
Her dad started to play the piano again. Her third piece from Carnegie Hall. He might as well have been playing Mom's CD.
"We're going to fly kites later. Me and Dad, I mean."
She didn't seem to hear him. Instead, she swiveled toward her dad.
"Would you just stop with that?"
she snapped. He stopped playing abruptly.
"What?"
"The music you're playing. You don't think I recognize those pieces? I know what you're doing, and I already told you I'm not going to play."
"I believe you," he said.
"Then why do you keep trying to get me to change my mind? Why is it that every time I see you, you're sitting there pounding away?"
He seemed genuinely confused. "It has nothing to do with you," he offered. "It just makes me feel better."
"Well, it makes me feel sick. Don't you get that? I hate the piano. I hate that I had to play it every single day. And I hate that I even have to see the damn thing anymore."
Before her dad could say another word, she turned,
snatched Jonah's Pop-Tart out of his hand, and stormed out the door. It took a couple of hours before she found Blaze in the same music store they'd visited yesterday, a couple of blocks from the pier. Ronnie hadn't known what to expect when they'd first visited the store. It seemed kind of antiquated these days in the age of iPods and downloads, but Blaze had assured her it would be worth it. And it had been. In addition to CDs, there were actual vinyl record albums, thousands of them, some of them most likely collector's items, including an unopened copy of Abbey Road, and a slew of old 45s simply hanging on the wall with signatures of people like Elvis Presley, Bob Marley, and Ritchie Valens. Ronnie was amazed that they weren't under lock and key. They had to be valuable, but the guy who managed the place looked like a throwback to the 60s and seemed to know everyone. He had long gray hair pulled back into a ponytail that reached his waist, and his glasses were the same kind John Lennon had favored. He wore sandals and a Hawaiian shirt, and though he was old enough to be Ronnie's grandfather, he knew more about music than anyone she'd ever met, including a lot of recent underground stuff she'd never even heard in New York. Along the back wall were headphones where customers could either listen to albums and CDs or download music onto their iPods. Peeking through the window this morning, she saw Blaze standing with one hand cupping a headphone to an ear, the other tapping the table in rhythm to whatever she was listening to. In no way was she prepared for a day at the beach. Ronnie took a deep breath and headed inside. As bad as it sounded, she didn't think Blaze should be getting drunk in the first place. She kind of hoped that Blaze had been so out of it that she'd forgotten what happened. Or, even better, that she had been sober enough to know that Ronnie had no interest in Marcus. As soon as she started down the aisle full of CDs, Ronnie sensed that Blaze had been expecting her. She turned down the volume on the headphones, though she didn't remove them from her ears, and turned around. Ronnie could still hear the music, something loud and angry she didn't recognize. Blaze gathered up the CDs. "I thought we were friends," she started. "We are," Ronnie insisted. "And I've been looking all over for you because I didn't want you to have the wrong idea about what went on last night." Blaze's expression was icy. "You mean about asking Marcus to go for a walk with you?" "It wasn't like that," Ronnie pleaded. "I didn't ask him. I don't know what his game was." "His game? His game?" Blaze threw down the headphones. "I saw the way you were staring at him. I heard what you said." "But I didn't say it. I didn't ask him to walk anywhere." "You tried to kiss him." "What are you talking about? I didn't try to kiss him." Blaze took a step forward. "He told me." "Then he's lying," Ronnie snapped, holding her ground. "There's something seriously wrong with that guy."
"No.
No. Don't even go there."
"He lied to you. I wouldn't kiss him. I don't even like him. The only reason I was there was because you insisted that we go."
For a long moment, Blaze didn't say anything. Ronnie wondered if she was finally getting through to her.
"Whatever,"
Blaze said, her tone making her meaning perfectly clear. She pushed past Ronnie, jostling her as she headed toward the door. Ronnie watched her go, unsure whether she was hurt or angry at the way Blaze had just acted, before deciding it was a bit of both. Through the window, Blaze stormed off.
"So much for trying to make things better."
Ronnie wasn't sure what to do next. She didn't want to go to the beach, but she didn't want to go home either. She didn't have access to a car, and she knew absolutely no one. Which meant, what? Maybe she'd end up spending the summer on some beach where she'd feed the pigeons like some of the weirder denizens of Central Park. Maybe she'd end up naming them. At the exit, her thoughts were brought to a halt by the sudden blaring of an alarm, and she glanced over her shoulder, first in curiosity and then in confusion as she realized what was happening. There was only one way in and out of the store. The next thing she knew, the ponytailed man was rushing toward her. She didn't try to run because she knew she'd done nothing wrong. When the ponytailed man asked for her bag, she saw no reason not to give it to him. Obviously, a mistake had been made. And it wasn't until the man removed two CDs and half a dozen of the signed 45s from her tote bag that she realized she'd been right about Blaze expecting Ronnie to find her. The CDs were the ones that Blaze had been holding, and Blaze had taken down the 45s from the wall.
In shock, she began to understand that Blaze had planned it all along. Suddenly dizzy, she barely heard the owner tell her that the police were already on their way.
Chapter 11. Steve. After buying the materials he needed, primarily 2x4s and sheets of plywood, Steve and Jonah spent the morning closing off the alcove. It wasn't pretty. His father would have been mortified, but Steve thought it would do. He knew the cottage would eventually be demolished. If anything, the land was worth more without it. The bungalow was flanked by 3-story mini-mansions, and Steve was certain those neighbors considered the place an eyesore that depressed their own property values. Steve hammered in a nail, hung the photograph of Ronnie and Jonah he'd removed from the alcove, and took a step back to examine his handiwork. "What do you think?" he asked Jonah. Jonah wrinkled his nose. "It looks like we built an ugly plywood wall and hung a picture on it. And you can't play the piano anymore, either."
"I know."
Jonah tilted his head from side to side. "I think it's crooked, too. It kind of bends in and out."
"I don't see anything."
"You need glasses, Dad. And I still don't see why you wanted to put it up in the first place."
"Ronnie said she didn't want to see the piano."
"So?"
"There's no place to hide the piano, so I put a wall up instead. Now she doesn't have to see it."
"Oh," Jonah said, thinking. "You know, I really don't like having to do homework. In fact, I don't even like to see it piled on my desk."
"It's summer. You don't have any homework."
"I'm just saying that maybe I should build a wall around the desk in my room."
Steve suppressed a laugh. "You might have to talk to your mom about that."
"Or you could."
Steve gave in to a chuckle.
"You hungry yet?" "You said we were going to go kite flying."
"We will. I just want to know if you want lunch."
"I think I'd rather have some ice cream."
"I don't think so."
"A cookie?"
Jonah sounded hopeful.
"How about a peanut butter and jelly sandwich?"
"Okay. But then we're going to fly the kite, right?"
"Yes."
"All afternoon?"
"As long as you want."
"Okay. I'll have a sandwich. But you have to have one, too."
Steve smiled, putting his arm on Jonah's shoulder.
"Deal." They headed toward the kitchen.
"You know, the living room is a whole lot smaller now," Jonah observed.
"I know."
"And the wall is crooked."
"I know."
"And it doesn't match the other walls."
"What's your point?"
Jonah's face was serious. "I just want to make sure you're not going crazy."
It was perfect kite-flying weather.
Steve sat on a dune 2 houses down from his own, watching the kite zigzag across the sky. Jonah, full of energy as usual, ran up and down the beach. Steve watched him with pride, amazed to recall that when he'd done the same thing as a child, neither of his parents had ever joined him. They weren't bad people, he knew that. They never abused him. He never went hungry. They never argued in his presence. He visited the dentist and doctor once or twice a year. There was always plenty to eat. And he always had a jacket on cold winter mornings and a nickel in his pocket so he could buy milk at school. But if his father was stoic, his mother wasn't all that different, and he supposed that was the reason they'd stayed married as long as they had. She was originally from Romania. His father had met her while stationed in Germany. She spoke little English when they were married and never questioned the culture in which she'd been raised. She cooked and cleaned and washed the clothes. In the afternoons, she worked part-time as a seamstress. By the end of her life, she'd learned passable English, enough to navigate the bank and grocery store. But even then, her accent was heavy enough that it was sometimes difficult for others to understand her. She was also a devout Catholic, something of an oddity in Wilmington at the time. She went to services every day and prayed the rosary in the evenings, and though Steve appreciated the tradition and ceremony of Mass on Sundays, The priest always struck him as a man who was both cold and arrogant, more interested in church rules than what might be best for his flock. Sometimes, many times, actually, Steve wondered how his life would have turned out had he not heard the music coming from the First Baptist Church when he was 8 years old. 40 years later, the details were fuzzy. He vaguely remembered walking in one afternoon and hearing Pastor Harris at the piano. He knew the pastor must have made him feel welcome, since he obviously went back again, and Pastor Harris eventually became his first piano teacher. In time, he began to attend, and then later ditch, the Bible study the church offered. In many ways, the Baptist church became his second home, and Pastor Harris became his second father. He remembered his mother wasn't happy about it. When upset, she would mutter in Romanian, and for years, whenever he left for the church, he would hear unintelligible words and phrases while she made the sign of the cross and forced him to wear a scapular. In her mind, having a Baptist pastor teach him the piano was akin to playing hopscotch with the devil. But she didn't stop him, and that was enough. It didn't matter to him that she didn't attend meetings with his teachers, or that she never read to him, or that no one ever invited his family to neighborhood barbecues or parties. What mattered was that she allowed him not only to find his passion, but to pursue it, even if she distrusted the reason, and that somehow she kept his father, who ridiculed the idea of earning a living through music, from stopping it as well. And for this, he would always love her. Jonah continued to jog back and forth, though the kite didn't require it. Steve knew the breeze was strong enough to hold it aloft unaided. He could see the outline of a Batman symbol silhouetted between two dark cumulus clouds, the kind that suggested rain was coming. Although the summer storm wouldn't last long, maybe an hour before the sky cleared again, Steve rose to tell Jonah that it might be a good time to call it a day. He took only a few steps before he noticed a series of faint lines in the sand that led to the dune behind his house, tracks he'd seen more than a dozen times when he was growing up. He smiled. "Hey, Jonah," he called out, following the tracks. "Come here. There's something I think you should see." Jonah jogged toward him, the kite tugging at his arm. "What is it?" Steve made his way down the dune to a spot where it merged with the beach itself. Only a few eggs were visible a couple of inches below the surface when Jonah reached his side. "What you got?" Jonah asked. "It's a loggerhead nest," Steve answered. "But don't get too close, and don't touch. You don't want to disturb it." Jonah leaned closer, still holding the kite. "What's a loggerhead?" he panted, struggling to control the kite. Steve reached for a piece of driftwood and began etching a large circle around the nest. "It's a sea turtle, an endangered one. They come ashore at night to lay their eggs." "Behind our house?" "This is one of the places sea turtles lay their eggs. But the main thing you should know is that they're endangered. Do you know what that means?" "It means they're dying," Jonah answered. "I watch Animal Planet, you know." Steve completed the circle and tossed aside the piece of driftwood. As he stood, he felt a flash of pain, but ignored it. "Not exactly. It means that if we don't try to help them and we're not careful, the species might become extinct." "Like the dinosaurs?" Steve was about to answer when he heard the phone in the kitchen begin to ring. He'd left the back door open to catch any stray breezes, and he alternately walked and jogged through the sand until he'd reached the back porch. He was breathing hard when he answered the phone. "Dad?" he heard on the other end. "Ronnie? I need you to pick me up. I'm at the police station." Steve reached up to rub the bridge of his nose. "Okay," he said. "I'll be right down." Officer Johnson told him what had happened, but he knew Ronnie wasn't ready to talk about it yet. Jonah, however, didn't seem to care. "Mom is going to be mad," Jonah remarked. Steve saw Ronnie's jaw clench. "I didn't do it," she started. "Then who did?" "I don't want to talk about it," she said. She crossed her arms and leaned against the car door. "Mom's not gonna like it." "I didn't do it," Ronnie repeated, swiveling toward Jonah. "And I don't want you to tell her that I did." She made sure he understood she was serious before turning to face her father. "I didn't do it, Dad," she repeated. "I swear to God I didn't. You have to believe me." He heard the desperation in her tone, but couldn't help remembering Kim's despair when they talked about Ronnie's history. He thought about the way she'd acted since she'd been here and considered the kinds of people she'd chosen to befriend. Sighing, he felt what little energy he had left dissipate. Ahead, the sun was a hot and furious orange ball, and more than anything, he knew his daughter needed the truth. "I believe you," he said. By the time they got home, dusk was setting in. Steve went outside to check on the turtle nest. It was one of those gorgeous evenings typical of the Carolinas. A soft breeze, the sky a quilt of a thousand different colors. And just offshore, a pod of dolphins played beyond the breakpoint. They passed by the house twice a day, and he reminded himself to tell Jonah to watch for them. No doubt he'd want to swim out to see if he could get close enough to touch them. Steve used to try the same thing when he was young, but never once had he been successful. He dreaded having to call Kim and tell her what happened. Putting it off, he took a seat on the dune beside the nest, staring at what was left of the turtle tracks. Between the wind and the crowds, most of them had been erased entirely. Aside from a small indentation at the spot where the dune met the beach, the nest was practically invisible, and the couple of eggs he could see resembled pale, smooth rocks. A piece of styrofoam had blown onto the sand, and as he leaned over to pick it up, he noticed Ronnie approaching. She was walking slowly, her arms crossed, head bowed so that her hair hid most of her face. She stopped a few feet away. "Are you mad at me?" she asked. It was the first time since she'd been here that she'd spoken to him without a hint of anger or frustration. "No," he said, "not at all." "Then what are you doing out here?" He pointed toward the nest. "A loggerhead turtle laid her eggs last night." "Have you ever seen one?" Ronnie shook her head, and Steve went on. "They're beautiful creatures. They've got this reddish-brown shell, and they can weigh up to 800 pounds. North Carolina is one of the few places they nest, but anyway, they're endangered. I think only 1 out of 1,000 live to maturity, and I don't want the raccoons to get the nest before they hatch." "How would the raccoons even know that a nest is here?" "When a female loggerhead lays her eggs, she urinates. The raccoons can smell it, and they'll eat every single one of the eggs. When I was young, I found a nest on the other side of the pier. One day, everything was fine, and the next day, all the shells had been broken open. It was sad. I saw a raccoon on our porch the other day." "I know. It's been getting into the garbage, and as soon as I go in, I'm going to leave a message with the aquarium. Hopefully they'll send someone by tomorrow with a special cage that'll keep the critters out." "What about tonight?" "I guess we're going to have faith." Ronnie tucked a strand of hair behind her ear. "Dad, can I ask you something?" "Anything." "Why did you say you believed me?" In profile, he could see both the young woman she was becoming and the little girl he remembered. "Because I trust you." "Is that why you built the wall to hide the piano?" She looked at him only indirectly. "When I went inside, it wasn't that hard to miss." Steve shook his head. "No. I did that because I love you." Ronnie flashed a brief smile, hesitating before taking a seat beside him. They watched the waves rolling steadily up the shore. High tide would be here soon, and the beach was half gone. "What's going to happen to me?" she asked. "Pete is going to talk to the owner, but I don't know. A couple of those records were real collector's items. They're pretty valuable." Ronnie felt sick to her stomach. "Have you told Mom yet?" "No." "Are you going to?" "Probably." Neither of them said anything for a moment. At the water's edge, a group of surfers walked past, holding their boards. In the distance, the swells were slowly rising, forming waves that seemed to collide before immediately reforming. "When are you going to call the aquarium?" "When I head back inside. I'm sure Joan is getting hungry anyway. I should probably start dinner." Ronnie stared at the nest. With her stomach in knots, she couldn't imagine eating. "I don't want anything to happen to the turtle eggs tonight." Steve turned toward her. "So, what do you want to do?" Hours later, after tucking Jonah into bed, Steve stepped out onto the back porch to check on Ronnie. Earlier, after he'd left a message at the aquarium, he'd gone to the store to buy what he thought she needed. A light sleeping bag, a camping lantern, a cheap pillow, and some bug spray. He wasn't comfortable with the idea of Ronnie sleeping outside, but she was clearly determined, and he admired her impulse to protect the nest. She'd been insistent that she would be fine, and to some extent, he trusted she was right. Like most people who grew up in Manhattan, she'd learned to be careful and had seen and experienced enough of the world to know it was sometimes a dangerous place. Moreover, the nest was less than 50 feet from his bedroom window, which he intended to keep open. So he was confident he'd hear something if Ronnie ran into trouble. Because of the shape of the wind-blown dune and the location of the nest, it wasn't likely that anyone walking on the beach would even know she was there. Still, she was only 17, and he was her father, all of which meant he'd probably end up checking on her every few hours. There wasn't a chance he'd be able to sleep through the night. The moon was only a sliver, but the sky was clear, and as he moved through the shadows, he thought back on their conversation. He wondered how she felt about the fact that he'd hidden the piano. Would she wake up tomorrow with the same attitude she'd had when she'd first arrived? He didn't know. As he drew near enough to make out Ronnie's sleeping form, the play of starlight and shadow made her appear both younger and older than she really was. He thought again about the years he'd lost and would never get back. He stayed long enough to gaze up and down the beach. As far as he could tell, no one was out, so he turned and headed back inside. He sat on the couch and turned on the television, flipping through the channels before turning it off. Finally, he went to his room and crawled in bed. He fell asleep almost immediately, but woke an hour later. Tiptoeing outside again, he went to check on the daughter he loved more than life itself.
Chapter 12. Ronnie. Her first thought upon waking was that everything hurt. Her back was stiff, her neck ached, and when she got the courage to sit up, a stabbing pain coursed through her shoulder. She couldn't imagine anyone ever choosing to sleep outdoors. When she was growing up, some of her friends had extolled the joys of camping, but she'd thought they were deranged. Sleeping on the ground hurt. And so, of course, did the blinding sun. Judging by the fact that she'd been waking up with a farmer since she arrived, she figured today was no different. It probably wasn't even 7 yet. The sun was hanging low over the ocean, and a few people were walking their dogs or jogging near the water's edge. No doubt, they'd slept in beds. She couldn't imagine walking, let alone exercising. Right now, it was hard enough to breathe without passing out. Steeling herself,
She slowly got to her feet before remembering why she'd been out here in the first place. She checked the nest, noting with relief that it was undisturbed. And ever so slowly, the aches and pains began to subside. She wondered idly how Blaze could tolerate sleeping on the beach. And then, all of a sudden, she remembered what Blaze had done to her. Arrested for shoplifting. Serious shoplifting. Felony shoplifting. She closed her eyes, reliving it all. The way the store owner had glared at her until the officer had arrived. Officer Pete's disappointment on the drive to the station. The awful phone call she'd had to make to her dad. She'd felt like throwing up on the car ride home. If there was one bright spot in all that had happened, it was that her dad hadn't blown a gasket. And even more incredible, he'd said he believed her to be innocent. Then again, he hadn't spoken to Mom yet. As soon as that happened, all bets were off. No doubt Mom would scream and shout until Dad gave in, and he'd end up grounding her because he'd promised Mom that he would. After the incident, her mom had grounded her for a month. And this was way, way bigger than just an incident. She felt sick again. She couldn't imagine having to spend an entire month in her room, a room she had to share, no less, in a place that she didn't want to be. She wondered if things could get any worse. As she stretched her arms above her head, she yelped at a stabbing pain in her shoulder. She lowered them slowly, wincing. She spent the next couple of minutes dragging her things to the back porch. Even though the nest was behind her house, she didn't want the neighbors to guess that she'd slept outside. Based on the grandeur of their houses, she pegged them as the kind of people who wanted everything picture perfect when they stood on their back decks drinking coffee in the mornings. The knowledge that someone had been sleeping beside their house probably didn't fit with their image of perfection. And the last thing she wanted was to have the police show up again. With her luck, she'd probably get arrested for vagrancy. Felony vagrancy. It took two trips to get everything. She didn't have the energy to carry it all at once. And then she realized she'd left behind her copy of Anna Karenina. She'd intended to read it last night, but she'd been too tired and set it under a piece of driftwood so the mist wouldn't ruin it. When she went back to get it, she spotted someone wearing a beige jumpsuit advertising Blakely Brakes, carrying a roll of yellow tape and a bunch of sticks. He seemed to be walking up the beach toward the house. By the time she'd retrieved her book, the man was closer and hunting around the dune. She started toward him, wondering what he was doing, and then he turned in her direction. When their eyes met, it was one of the few times in her life that she actually felt tongue-tied. She recognized him immediately, despite the uniform. She flashed on the way he'd looked without a shirt, tan and fit, his brown hair wet with sweat, the macrame bracelet on his wrist. He was the guy at the volleyball court who'd crashed into her. The guy whose friend almost got into a fight with Marcus. Coming to a halt in front of her, he didn't seem to know what to say either. Instead, he just stared at her. Although she knew it was crazy, she had the impression that he was somehow pleased to run into her again. She could see it in his dawning recognition, in the way he began to smile at her, none of which made any sense. "Hey, it's you," he said. "Good morning." She wasn't sure what to think, other than to question the friendly tone. "What are you doing here?" she asked. "I got a call from the aquarium. Someone called last night to report a loggerhead nest, and they asked me to come here to check it out." "You work for the aquarium?" He shook his head. "I just volunteer there. I work at my dad's brake shop. You wouldn't happen to have seen a turtle nest around here, would you?" She felt herself relax a little. "It's over there," she said, pointing. "Hey, that's great," he smiled. "I was hoping it was near a house." "Why?" "Because of storms. If the waves wash over the nest, the eggs won't make it." "But they're sea turtles." He raised his hands. "I know. It doesn't make sense to me either, but that's the way nature works. Last year, we lost a couple of nests when a tropical storm came through. It was really sad. They're endangered, you know. Only 1 out of 1,000 live to maturity."
"Yeah, I know."
"You do?" He sounded impressed.
"My dad told me."
"Oh," he said. He motioned down the beach with a friendly wave. "I take it you live around here?"
Why do you want to know?
Just making conversation, he answered easily.
My name's Will, by the way.
Hi, Will.
He paused.
Interested.
What?
Usually when someone introduces himself, the other person does the same.
I'm not most people.
Ronnie crossed her arms, careful to keep her distance.
I already figured that out.
He flashed a quick smile.
I'm sorry about running into you at the volleyball game.
You already apologized, remember?
I know, but you seemed kind of mad.
My soda went down my shirt.
That's too bad, but you should really try to pay more attention to what's going on.
Excuse me?
It's a fast-moving game.
She put her hands on her hips.
Are you trying to say it was my fault?
Just trying to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Like I said, I felt bad about what happened.
With his answer, she got the feeling he was trying to flirt with her, but she didn't know why.
It didn't make sense.
She knew she wasn't his type, and frankly, he wasn't her type either. But at this early hour, she wasn't in the mood to try to figure it out. Instead, she motioned to the items he was holding, thinking it was probably better to get back to the subject at hand.
How is that tape supposed to keep the raccoons away?
It doesn't. I'm just here to mark the nest. I run the tape around the dowels so the guys who do put up the cage know where to find the nest.
When are they going to put it up?
I don't know, he shrugged.
Maybe in a couple of days?
She thought about the agony she'd experienced upon waking, and she began to shake her head.
No, I don't think so. You call them and tell them that they have to do something to protect the nest today. Tell them I saw a raccoon last night hovering around the nest.
Did you?
Just tell them, okay?
As soon as I'm finished, I'll make sure to call. I promise. She squinted up at him, thinking that was too easy. But before she could dwell on it further, her dad stepped onto the back porch.
Good morning, sweetheart, he called out. I've got breakfast going if you're hungry.
Will looked from Ronnie to her dad and back again.
You live here.
Instead of answering, she took a step backward.
Just make sure you tell the people at the aquarium, okay?
She started back toward the house and had stepped onto the porch when she heard Will call out.
Hey!
She turned.
You didn't tell me your name.
No, she answered. I don't suppose I did. As she headed for the door, she knew she shouldn't look back, but she couldn't help stealing a quick peek over her shoulder. When he raised an eyebrow, she kicked herself mentally, glad that she hadn't told him her name. In the kitchen, her dad was standing over a frying pan at the stove, stirring with a spatula. On the counter beside him lay a packet of tortillas, and Ronnie had to admit that whatever he was making smelled terrific. Then again, she hadn't eaten since yesterday afternoon.
Hey there, he said over his shoulder. Who was that you were talking to?
Just some guy from the aquarium. He's here to mark the nest.
What are you making?
A vegetarian breakfast burrito.
You're kidding.
It has rice, beans, and tofu. It all goes in the tortilla. I hope that's okay. I found the recipe online, so I can't vouch for how it tastes.
I'm sure it's fine, she said.
She crossed her arms, thinking she might as well get this over with.
Have you talked to Mom yet?
He shook his head.
No, not yet.
I did talk to Pete this morning, though.
He said he still hadn't been able to talk to the owner yet. She's out of town.
She?
It seems the man who works there is the owner's nephew. But Pete said he knows the owner pretty well.
Oh, she said, wondering if that would make any difference.
Her dad tapped the spatula on the pan.
Anyway, I just figured that it might be a good idea if I held off calling your mom until I have the details.
I'd hate to have to worry her unnecessarily.
You mean you might not have to tell her?
Unless you want me to.
No, that's okay, she said quickly.
You're right. It's probably better if we wait.
Okay, he agreed.
After one last stir, he turned off the burner.
I think this is just about ready. Are you hungry?
Starved, she confessed.
As she approached, he took down a plate from the cupboard and added a tortilla, then scooped some of the mixings onto it. He offered it to her.
Is that enough?
Plenty, she said.
Do you want coffee? I've got a pot going.
He reached for a coffee cup and handed it to her. Jonah mentioned that sometimes you go to Starbucks, so that's what I bought. It might not be as good as what they make in their stores, but it's the best I can do. She took the cup, staring at him. Why are you being so nice to me?
Why shouldn't I be?
Because I haven't been very nice to you, she could have said. But she didn't.
Thanks,
she mumbled instead, thinking the whole thing felt like some weird Twilight Zone episode, where her dad had somehow completely forgotten the last 3 years. She poured herself some coffee and took a seat at the table. Steve joined her a moment later with his own plate and began to roll his burrito. How was it last night? Did you sleep okay?
Yeah, when I slept. Waking up wasn't so easy.
I realized too late that I probably should have picked up an air mattress.
It's okay. But after breakfast, I think I'm going to lie down for a while. I'm still kind of tired.
It's been a long couple of days.
Maybe you shouldn't have coffee.
It won't matter. Believe me, I'll be out. Behind them, Jonah walked into the kitchen wearing Transformers pajamas, his hair poking out all over. Ronnie couldn't help smiling.
Good morning, Jonah, she said.
Are the turtles okay?
They're fine, she said.
Good job, he said. He scratched his back as he walked to the stove.
What's for breakfast?
Breakfast burritos, her dad answered. Warily, Jonah studied the mixings in the pan, then the items on the counter.
Don't tell me you went over to the dark side, Dad.
Steve tried to stifle his smile.
It's good.
It's tofu! It's disgusting! Ronnie laughed as she pushed back from the table.
How about I get you a Pop-Tart instead?
He seemed to be trying to decide if this was some kind of trick question.
With chocolate milk?
Ronnie glanced at her dad.
There's plenty in the fridge, he said.
She poured him a glass and set it on the table. Jonah didn't move.
Okay, what's going on?
What do you mean?
This isn't normal, he said. Someone should be mad. Someone's always mad in the mornings.
Are you talking about me? Ronnie asked. She put two Pop-Tarts in the toaster.
I'm always cheerful.
Yeah, right, he said. He squinted at her.
Are you sure the turtles are okay? Because the two of you are acting like they died.
They're fine, I promise, Ronnie assured him.
I'm going to check.
Go ahead. He studied her.
After breakfast, he added.
Steve smiled and glanced over at her.
So, what's on your agenda today?
He asked.
After your nap.
Jonah reached for his milk.
You never take naps.
I do when I'm tired.
No, he said, shaking his head. This isn't right.
He put the milk back down.
Something weird is going on, and I'm not leaving here until I find out what it is.
After she'd finished eating, and once Jonah had been placated, Ronnie retired to her room. Steve followed with some towels that he draped over the